sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
U.S. markets post the first down month in a long time. Bonds have one of the worst quarters ever, and gold's quarter, the worst since 1968. And we have Katie North from Bloomberg Markets talking some government issues, and we're specifically going to focus in on the banking sector. All this and much more on episode number 320 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good welcome to July to you, and I hope that you're going to do something away from the office, away from the market, spend a little time refreshing, recuperating, and then coming back with some real good ideas. One of the things that I always really understood was that you have to take a break every once in a while. Now, I know that a lot of people listening are not professional traders. You do other things in life, but you know what? With that, you still have to take a break. It's just like the football player. You know, they don't play every single week. Yeah, they do in the season, but they need a break. They need a body to rebuild, to reinvigorate themselves, to get time off, to stretch, to think. This is what sometimes is very, very good. So for anybody out there that is doing this, you know, your job, maybe, you know, you're really focused in on something that is really taking over your time. And I should listen to myself about this, by the way. A break is good to do, you know, whether it's at the beach, whether it's just simply going for a drive somewhere, clearing your head, and especially if things aren't working well for you in the markets, one of the things you could do is sometimes step back, take a look from a little bit further away, gain some perspective, and from there, come back to it. There's a lot going on in markets around the world, and it is absolutely deafening to listen to all the different analysts, the television stations that bring on all their guests, and all of them have, of course, 12 different opinions. And you hear this on a daily basis. Some of the well-known financial shows have been really digging into the whole issue about the Fed, and many of the guests have been talking about how the markets have got it wrong. One of the things that I think we all need to be aware of, and at least convinced of, the markets don't have anything wrong. They never have anything wrong. It's only if you're not investing correctly along with the markets, because the market is essentially right. You can't look back and say, well, the market for this went up during that time and it really shouldn't. It did. End of sentence. It's moving in any particular direction at any given time, and that is correct for the time that it's doing it. Now, whether or not you want to say that you should be, the market should have gone this and reacted this way, and that, okay, you want to use some kind of, you know, rationalization to what's going on, but don't think that the markets are wrong, because that's, you know, not going to happen. Now, if you want to stay out of it because you don't agree with how the masses are playing it at that exact moment, okay, fine. But you'll know that price is always right. That's the ultimate winner of the argument. So whether or not you see that a particular stock has value or not, if it moves up and you're short, you're wrong. If it moves down and you're long, you're wrong. Keep that in mind. Realize that it's not you who influences the market. It's the market that is the influence, and following along with it is probably the best thing that you can do at, you know, at any given time. It's not always at that given moment, but following along at least the signals that you see what's happening, trying to get a little bit more information and making good decisions. Again, it's not going to be for every single situation. And when I talk about the markets, I'm talking about an individual stock or an ETF, or the markets as a whole, commodities, whatever it may be. But to think that they can come on and say the markets have gotten it wrong, and of course some of these stations love to do the cheerleading, you know who I'm talking about there, and they talk about how the Fed is this, the Fed's doing that. It is overwhelming how much the Fed has started to, or has continued to, really permeate into the daily market process. We heard from Lacker saying that not only is the Fed going to not take away the punch bowl, but they're spiking it. We heard from someone else last week, Kachalakara. He's talking about how, you know, it's going to be a certain amount of time. And they're all coming out trying to calm the markets instead of trying their best to do what's right for the economy. Because the only tool they have really is to, at their best, and in I say this in its sincerest form, to manipulate the markets into believing that everything is okay in order to make sure the confidence is high. So therefore, there's investment, creating a wealth effect. And therefore, that translates into possibly more money, higher confidence, consumer confidence, and the ability then to reinvigorate the economy. That's the only tool they have. So they use it. And if you think it's a negative or a positive, okay, but they can't do anything else about it. So it all depends on how long the market, the people, the investors will go along with what they're saying in that the low interest rate environment and buying of bonds is helping to reinvigorate the economy. And for the most part, the only thing that really that I've seen that it's been doing is creating a lot better looking balance sheets for corporations and at the same time creating extraordinary amounts of liquidity in the system. Of course, it's also been able to hold down interest rates, thereby at least holding them down long enough that some buyers could start nibbling back into the housing market, which has been doing very well. We saw the Case-Shiller number out early last week. We talked about that on DH Unplugged, and it is up very nicely again. It's continuing up 10, 12%, you know, on a year-over-year basis, and we're seeing that the home builders are doing well, pending sales. We saw a really nice uptick, the highest in years that we saw in pending sales. New housing starts were, you know, good. They were a little bit less than expected, but that's fine. They were pretty good. Existing home sales are very good as well. So all in all, the housing market is starting to heal. There are some areas that are still pretty, I would say, they're not really picking up at all. But then there's other areas, particularly the big cities, the central hubs, North, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. You got Florida, especially in Miami. Some areas in Texas, some of the Midwest where there's some good farming land, there's been some real good pickup, and California, can't forget about that as well, and that's probably one of the best areas that we've seen. So when we look at the markets, when we look at what the Fed's doing, they are communicating, unfortunately, a very confusing message right now, because on one hand, they're talking about how they like to start cutting back on bond purchases. Okay. On the other hand, we see other Fed speakers come out and talk about how they're not going to do it right now. So the open communication that they're trying to bring us, I think, is very confusing. And I wish they wouldn't do it. Keep us guessing a little bit. It makes for a much better game. Keep us in the dark about some of the stuff until you're doing it. At least we don't have to deal with this daily fluctuation, weekly fluctuation that is all dependent on what the Fed is thinking at that moment and who is speaking, whether they're hawkish or dovish. So that's just something I really find to be very distracting for most people. And that many TV stations are talking about this night and day is quite frankly ridiculous. But the bond market has taken to heart some of the things that have gone on. Now, I question whether or not the bond market has moved so dramatically, about 4%, and the junk bond market has been hacksawed pretty well this period. And we also saw a big rotation, which I'm going to talk to you about in a second, in equities this quarter and this last 6, 12 weeks. The bond market is moving because the Fed has said they're going to start moving out of their bond buying program, right? Is that really the case? Is it the case that the U.S. economy is better? Certain areas are better. Or maybe it's that rates went too low. There were too many people involved in bonds. They overleveraged themselves. And when the slightest amount of problems arise with the fact that maybe Japan has overleveraged themselves to a point that if rates go up, they're going to be in big trouble. So there's money being pulled out of there. There's money being pulled out of the U.S. because, obviously, out of bonds, because there's concern over the amount of debt we have. Who knows what started this? But in the end, yields have gone up dramatically on the short term, but more on the long term, long end of the curve. And it has obviously affected mortgages. And even though the Fed is continuing to buy at this point the $85 billion per month, they're not making a dent on this. And in fact, the Japanese yields have also moved higher, although they stabilized, even though there's an unlimited amount that's going to be purchased. And we're also seeing the bonds of emerging markets and other areas starting to feel some of this pressure. And one of the things that you have to realize is that it also is a big effect you see on things like interest rate sensitive investments. So, for example, look at the REITs out there. Look at the housing REIT or the housing proxy for the home builders, for example. They really had some problems for a while there. And the housing market and the rentals, which are high yielders. You look at the high yield bonds, there's been some problems. Utilities really came down. All of the higher yielding positions had problems. And this is a natural process that is a self-adjusting mechanism that when yields go higher, the principal value will go down. That's a simple, just think of a seesaw. It's not a theory. It's a fact, okay? That when interest rates go down, bond prices will go up. And when bond prices go down, interest rates go up. It's just simple. Don't even think about it. It's what happens. And where we are right now is as we see that interest rates have gone higher, well, then that really caused some problems in some of the underlying areas that maybe weren't directly related to bonds. But now it's no longer such a great investment because if you can get a if you're coming into an environment that you can get a free, I would say a risk-free level of involvement in a product that has a high yield or higher yield, then you're going to go to that. That's a natural process, by the way. Think about it. So if you can get 4% on a CD or 4%, let's say, on a stock, well, the CD is guaranteed. You're not going to lose any principal. And if you're looking for the yield, you would have gone with the CD. So those that are looking for income are going to naturally move towards those positions that are less of risk. And that creates the movement usually out of equities. Now, at the same time, there was this big theory that if bond yields started to move up because people were selling it, that they'd rotate them into equities, right? But I haven't seen that. In fact, there's a high correlation very recently of if the bonds are being bought, stocks are being bought. If stocks are being sold, bonds are being sold. Now, how do you have both? That's the real question. How do you have both? How do you look at when you see a bond being purchased, usually because of a safety trade, but at the same time, stocks are being bought and vice versa? Now, also you've seen that there's been a flight out of commodities. There's been a big move out of commodities. Now, listen to this. Listen to what happened during the quarter. Crude held pretty well. This is pretty interesting because that's one of the only ones that held so well. During the quarter, it was down only about 1%. Brent crude was down 7%. Gas prices were down. Gasoline prices were down 11%. Heating oil down 1%. Then you have natural gas down 8%. Gold was down 22% for the quarter. Silver was down 30%. Platinum down 15%. Palladium down 15%. Aluminum down 7%. Copper down 10%. Those are pretty serious numbers. Those are pretty serious numbers. You know, you're talking about a quarter, just a three-month period, that you're seeing this kind of collapse in commodities. So money's being pulled out of there too. So you got money coming out of the markets, money coming out of commodities, money coming out of emerging markets, money coming out of bonds. Where's it going? Well, there's two answers. One, they're deleveraging. So if you have an investment, you have an investment account, and let's say there's $100,000 in it, and you're buying all sorts of things, and you start levering up. So now you have $150,000 or so dollars worth of things, you know, different investments in there. And you start selling. Well, the first thing you sell is to get yourself deleveraged, bring it back down to 100% or lower. So now what you did was you moved the markets up, or the masses with leveraging, move the markets up because of the leveraging. And the next thing that happens is you delever and you take it back down. So you get rid of the borrowed funds, you get rid of the investments that you had on those borrowed funds. And now what happens? Well, the money doesn't go anywhere. It goes back to filling up the leverage that you took out, the margin, the loan that you took in order to buy the things that you bought. So that being the case, that makes a lot of sense. That these all these things will leverage pretty well, and that's how you got that big move recently. and the big spike up in a variety of things. And now they're starting to delever and move out of things. So that's why it's not showing up in other asset classes. So just think about that. What's working and what's not? The rotation recently has been pretty severe. Banks were in favor for a real good time. They started to break down a bit. The things that I'm seeing in terms of rotation are the energy is getting hot again, materials getting hot again, and the industrials are starting to roll up. And these have come down a bit. Utilities is probably one of the worst. Telecom is probably one of the second worst. Financials, again, have been doing pretty well. Consumer discretionary is probably one of the better ones, which is very interesting if you think about it. Consumers really haven't slowed down very much at all. And any slowdown that they've had has been tolerated pretty well. But what's coming up and what's starting to rotate into an improving area from a lagging and a weakening, so we go to improving and leading, is information technology. Tech is starting to really move better. Energy is starting to get in that range. It's not there yet, but it's getting in that range. And the financials and the consumer discretionary are really right in there. The consumer staples are starting to weaken. And that has to do with the fact that they are so dependent oftentimes on outside of the U.S., foreign exports. And what happens is that because we're seeing a lot of slowdown around the world, they're suffering. So the multinationals in the consumer staple area are something that I really question how that's going to play out. As a matter of fact, we talked about in the Trigger Point Research setup videos that we have on YouTube at youtube.com/triggerpointresearch. You can subscribe to it. We put it up on Trigger Point Research. It's freebie. And we talked about Procter & Gamble last week, that the potential is for them to break down, and we showed kind of what the setup was. Now, it's not there yet, but there is the potential for this thing to roll down a bit and to see some kind of movement out if, in fact, we see the continued weakness in the emerging markets and in the Asian markets, et cetera. When we look at Asia, obviously, we see a real big problem when it comes to China. China has been just a mess. Between their manufacturing numbers are horrible. Their banks are illiquid. There had to be that injection last week into the banking sector. And that freaks me out all the time. When I hear the word injection from a government to a bank, it just bugs me out. The reason is that it's at the last minute. That's it. They can't do anything more. So we haven't heard about this for however long it is. And now all of a sudden we're getting an injection, meaning that things are pretty bad. You know, a bank doesn't get a quote-unquote injection. Think about that. They don't get this kind of money pushed into it unless the entire system of that bank is frozen. There's no money available. There's little amount of things that they can do. They cannot distribute money because everything's locked up. The money they owe, the money they have is matched, and they have no flow. So there's a real problem there. Now, given the fact that China did put money into the system, into the banking sector, into certain banks, that's a good thing because it does free them up from an immediate and impending collapse or freeze. But at the same time, what else is lurking? What else is problematic? They can't get a handle on their inflation. Their housing prices in Beijing and Shanghai are still skyrocketing from the last numbers that we saw, assuming we could trust those. But at the same time, they're having this big problem holding down inflation and at the same time, you know, creating any additional exports because they're seeing such weakness around the world that's really affecting them. So I take a look at that China area. Did pop a little bit last week into the end of the week, but really has been very, very soft. So some very big, enormous down days in the last couple of weeks. So in the summertime, I want to mention that usually you have a layoff of a volume. You see that traders have gone to wherever they go. In New York, they go to the Hamptons, and you know they move around, and they're maybe working half of Friday up in New York, and that's how it is up there. I used to live up there. And volume is pretty light. Now, what happens when volume is light is that you have the opportunity to move things a little bit wider. And if you've noticed, if you look at a chart right now, look at a daily chart of a stock, look at the market, the S&P, the Dow, there's a lot more range that we're seeing lately. The volatility is up, and you're seeing, if you look at candles, a lot more wicks, the area between the top and the bottom and the range on the day. A lot more of this sloppy action. And you're going to probably see more of that throughout the summer as we do usually see a much higher level of volatility because of the fact that there's just less liquidity. And that's why the summer doldrums are usually there, and you get that kind of final quarter of the year afterwards where things pick up when everybody gets back to work and does their thing. But the summertime, the July-August period, is oftentimes a period where you do see corrections, which are healthy, by the way. The last one we saw recently from top to bottom was about 7.5%. That just was this month, from top to bottom. And this is a healthy part of the process. You can't have markets go just in one direction. You know, it's up or down, for that matter. And you do see at the same time where you'll see a bottoming out of something. For example, the gold miners last week, they were taking a shellacking for the last, I think it was 40 weeks, just getting the crap kicked out of them. And the gold miners on Friday made a big turnaround. And if you were lucky enough to grab that, we did for our clients, we grabbed a position in NUGT, Nugget, which is a triple ETF. It's a trading position. But we grabbed the position, and it was up 21% on Friday. Pretty substantial. And that's because gold managed to hold. The day before, gold was down. And at the same time, there were some participation in the miners. So now you're starting to perk up, and you had a short squeeze. It was great. How long will that last? Well, the big problem you have is that the lower the price of gold, the more that the miners have difficulty meeting with expectations for profit. And the fact is they can't be profitable. They have to close things down, cut expenses. They also have to, you know, simply shut up mines. And this causes a problem. So what happens then is less supply. Gold prices may go higher. And it's good for them. It's bad for them. It's a real, you know, some companies may go out of business. So be careful if you're going to work on this area, but realize that there is sometimes opportunities when you see this kind of movement down, where you see that there will be people looking to build on the positions. Their costs are high. They're looking to average cost into a little bit lower, and they're committed to it. So there was an opportunity. There may be an opportunity. I would watch them. And this market has been all about a rotation over the last couple of years, and especially the last 6 months, where there's a big rotation moving in, and when something's moving down, they pick it up. And then you bring it higher and, you know, rolls down and rolls around. So keep your eye on that. Let's get to our guest, and then I'll come back and we're going to talk about a few more things and then wrap it up. And hopefully we're going to have some insight in a moment into what's going on with the Dodd-Frank. And I have some questions to ask. And again, we have a special guest today. We have Katie North, who is a writer. She's actually an analyst. I shouldn't say that, but she does write a lot. That's how analysts get their information across. She's an analyst, senior analyst with Bloomberg Governments. And she covers a lot of things. But one of the things she really is focused on these days is Dodd-Frank. And, you know, we used to hear about that a lot. But what happened to it? So let's talk to what's the story with this, my friend? Is there anything new?
Well, next month, actually, we're going to have the third anniversary of Dodd-Frank. So happy birthday, Dodd-Frank 3. And, you know, as of this month, we are only about 60% of the way completed in terms of regulators finishing all the major actions that they had to do to implement Dodd-Frank. There's still about 22% or so, roughly a quarter of the actions that haven't even been started yet. So there's a long way to go, and primarily a lot of these activities that we're waiting on are the big ones, like the Volcker Rule, like a major set of new prudential standards and counterparty credit exposure limits and capital requirements that were all mandated by Dodd-Frank.
Now, maybe I'm kind of stupid, but why can't they get this done?
Well, the interesting thing about Dodd-Frank is, one, its size and length. I mean, thousands of pages, spurring tens of thousands of pages of regulations. But there's a collective kind of thing going on with about 10 different financial regulators working to implement various parts of the law. And sometimes they have to collaborate, sometimes they don't. Usually when they have to collaborate, like on the Volcker Rule, there's a lot of delays happening in that all of these agencies have to manage their own workloads. They have different staff working on different things. The SEC was without a chair for several months, so that created a problem with the Securities and Exchange Commission being able to complete any of their major rulemaking. So it's sort of a little bit of it's political, a little bit of it is sort of time management and ability to have enough people on the ground working these regulations.
Well, because, you know, like the Commodity Future Trading Board, I mean, it seems like they had all these rules that were supposed to be done for so long and they could never get it done. And then, you know, you wonder what else is not being done because they can't get these basic things that they were that they were commanded to, or you know, they were told this has to be done by this date, and they keep on postponing it. You know, I think that's the funny thing is that in private business, if you had a deadline to get something done and you didn't, you get fired. And in,
yeah,
I guess
it's interesting.
In public,
yeah,
you don't seem to get fired.
Yeah, the government, you really what happens when these rules aren't met, the deadlines aren't met, is Congress comes to the regulator and says, why hasn't this been completed yet? And the regulator has to say something about it, but there's no, you know, nothing more than a slap on the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to the CFTC in particular, they have done a great job of getting rules out, but not necessarily in any kind of order that makes it easy for business to understand.
Right.
And sort of the sequencing of a lot of the rules has been held up because they're using procedural methods of what's called a no-action letter to kind of go back and sweep up the messes that they made with some of the rules. So it makes it even more confusing, not only to track, but from a business perspective in being able to kind of fully understand what it is you have to do and sequencing that with your own business needs.
Right.
It does make it very confusing. And I think it might get even more confusing this summer because Gary Gensler, the chair of the CFTC, it's possible he might step down.
Good.
There could be some discussion
about
a replacement for him as chair. And the timing of that may also influence, you know, the completion of some of this rulemaking as well.
I mean, I've met him and I've listened to him. I'm just saying I'm not impressed, okay? That's all I'm saying. I was very surprised in a conversation I had with him some time ago about their oversight of things like, you know, leakage of information about margin requirements and how it seems that before the news is out at the end of the day, oftentimes you'd see a lot of the commodities move dramatically and you don't find out till the end of the day this happens. And I'm thinking, well, somebody had to know something because this is just out of the ordinary, this move. And he said he basically didn't have anything to do with that. And I said, wait a minute, aren't you the guys that oversee this? I mean, but anyway. Let's talk about what some of this Dodd-Frank means to the individual and in terms of how, you know, this really can be translated. In terms of, you know, what does this mean? I mean, the too big to fail has been something that has been in the consciousness of all of us for some time. And the question is that the bank, or the point is the banks keep getting bigger. And, you know, we have things like the gigantic London Whale trade that goes, you know, negative against J.P. Morgan by, what, $7 billion or so? And it, so what? You know, like $7 billion. So, you know, that wasn't a big deal. They make a lot more in doing all the other things they do. But if you really think about that for a second, that's a large amount of money. And nothing happened to prevent this from happening again. We have the MF Global blow up. What does this mean to the individual? How are they going to be protected by this? Because that's really the intent of this Dodd-Frank, right?
Certainly. And the reality is that a lot of those rules meant to provide cushions to the banks and safety nets and protections really haven't been implemented yet. And that's part of a package of so-called prudential standards that the Fed has been working on since they initially proposed them back in 2011. And we just haven't seen the final rules come out yet. There have been some progress made on sort of the designation of non-bank systemically important financial institutions. But sort of the treatment of those versus their bank peers is still very unclear. It's still a big question mark. And so ultimately, you know, we are going to continue hearing a lot about this too big to fail debate, a lot about the potential funding advantage for these very large institutions and other benefits they might receive until we get some finalization of some of these Dodd-Frank rules. And even then, it's possible that a future crisis could bring this all back to the forefront all over again.
But, you know, what I find really interesting is that with regard to the implementation of some of these, that they would go and, you know, work with the banks that didn't need this whole issue more than they work with the banks that did need it. And on top of that, I don't really have a lot of confidence in the ability to for our lawmakers to do anything with these banks because there's too much at stake for them from a couple of different points, right? So number one, from a campaign standpoint, from getting campaign donations that now we have an unlimited amount in some areas and all. And the second thing is for their future job prospects as, you know, a lobbyist and all that, or whatever they're going to do with the firm after the fact. So I don't really know how much of a strict mandate they're going to take and how much they're going to really try to focus in. And you could tell by their, you know, what are we now? We're 4 or 5 years past, let's call it 4 years, okay, past the big, you know, meltdown of the industry, which is, by the way, years past the last meltdown and then years past the last meltdown before that. We still don't have any regulations that are meaningful.
Right. And things keep changing. And that's one of the problems with sort of regulating after the fact, after there's a large crisis, is that you tend to focus on the areas that you think there were problems before and focus like a laser on those things, not seeing potential problems down the line. And there were some safety nets kind of put into Dodd-Frank, the concept of a Financial Stability Oversight Council that's meant to monitor systemic risk over time and take a look at trends and different changes and things like that. But still, it's sort of untested. And we don't have a full faith and credit in what could happen in a future crisis. And even just this week, banks have been going through this process of filing what's called a living will, in where they have to take a look at the bankruptcy code, how they would wind themselves down and sell parts and pieces of them off so they could remain healthy and open so their customers could utilize their products. Now, a former staff person from the FDIC who was high up in this said he doesn't think that these living wills are sort of up to snuff. And the FDIC is not going to come out and deem any of them uncredible at this point because they're trying to really work out the kinks with the process. But as of now, 3 years after Dodd-Frank, we still don't have kind of credible plans in place that would actually work in the event of a crisis. And so hopefully it doesn't happen soon, right? Hopefully it's something that happens much further down the line, and maybe they will have, gotten up enough information from this sort of new risk management kind of profile that they have to do with regards to living wills and other things. But it's just not quite there yet.
Well, here's a kind of a fresh idea, okay? Maybe, or maybe a fresh thought. Maybe if actually the government didn't come and back every, aside from Lehman and some of the small guys, but back every single bank and make sure that to this day they keep flooding money into the banking sector, okay? And backing the European banks through backdoor transactions and transmittals. We know all about that because it came out. It's very clear. But maybe if that didn't happen and there was some real pain, that the there would be something done to create some kind of platform so that it wouldn't happen again. But right now, really, if it did happen again, who cares? The Fed's going to come to the rescue. It's come to the rescue here. It's come to the rescue in Europe. It comes to the rescue around the world all the time. I mean, I don't really understand where the impetus is anyway to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, Dodd-Frank simultaneously did two kind of separate things. It took away some of the Fed's power to be the lender of the last resort in a lot of cases, but then it gave the FDIC some additional power to take some upfront Treasury funds to provide some initial liquidity in the event of a future crisis to help wind down some firms. And there's a big question as to whether there would be the political appetite in the event of a future crisis to allow the Treasury to upfront some money, even though it's supposed to be paid back by the largest banks ex post after all, everything is said and done. Mm-hmm. The FDIC in reality has never had to go through that kind of a process before, and so we don't know how it'll work. It's sort of all written down as this kind of plan on paper, but they've yet to have to go through it.
Does anybody realize that there is so much focus on the banking sector? And I realize that it, quote unquote, holds our money and all this. But does anybody have any idea that we don't have to do this for other sectors? What's the big difference? Is the difference that other sectors realize they don't have anybody backing them up? The banks have been backed for, 100 years? Mm-hmm. And they haven't had the situation. It's kind of like, hey, listen, if I was in business and I knew that I have a large inheritance behind me, or I have a big daddy behind me, that if I screwed up in business and I made all these investments into these things, I could always fall back on daddy. He's just giving me money. I don't know how conscientious I would be in all of my daily actions. And
right, it's a matter of what the repercussion is.
Yeah, there's no repercussions.
Payback, and you have different models of how this works. Obviously the FDIC insurance fund everyone pays into it up front as a backstop. A lot of the other tools that were developed in Dodd-Frank are all things that would be paid back after the failures happen by the remaining kind of whoever's left in the playing field. And that's a big difference from sort of what's in existence for the FDIC insurance fund as it stands today.
Hold on. I got to interrupt you. So you're telling me that they get the money up front, and if they fail, they pay back what's left?
Yeah, they pay back anything.
Oh, I love that.
But the new bailout regime under Dodd-Frank, it's an initial bailout of, providing temporary liquidity guarantees. And then they would use that to wind down the firm that was failing or firms multiple. And then after it's all said and done and whatever is not paid back from that initial upfront payment, there would be a fee structure put into place on the remaining systemically important financial institutions to repay over time the cost.
The other ones. Talking about the other ones.
Yeah, the other ones. Yeah, the ones who remain, who are left.
So then they have a vested interest in keeping them, either absorbing them or keeping them solid or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But right now they pay in up front and then it's everyone for themselves.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the way FDIC insurance works for deposits anyway, for the backstop on deposits.
Right.
But we're talking a broader backstop of the entire bank holding company structure.
I don't understand. I guess here's the thing. I remember a day because I was, you know, around. There was a couple of things that seemed important to me. There was the uptick rule, which always seemed reasonably important, that you couldn't, you know, crush a stock just to crush it. Of course, we have the naked short rule, which, you know, gets implemented and sometimes not. And then you have also the Glass-Steagall. And Glass-Steagall was clearly a very wise idea that I always thought, where you separate the banking industry from the insurance and the financial, and you kept it, you know, in separate corners, because if any one particular entity had full control potential over your money, then there was the potential for all sorts of bad things. It's kind of like how myself as a money manager, it would be a very bad idea if I was also the trustee, the sole trustee on somebody's trust, on a client's trust, right? Because then I could kind of, I'm the one that's watching over myself and I can take out money and I have to report to myself.
Right.
It's kind of the same thing, you know, whereas why don't they ever talk about this? It's out of their league. Even the Volcker rule is only about primarily, you know, trading issues, prop trading.
Right.
Why don't they just go back to where we were and just move on? It was fine back then.
Well, I mean, I think one of the issues is banks are trying to manage a very long-term, low-interest rate environment through kind of short-term gains and losses. And that's a model that isn't always very sustainable. And so that's the reason why they've engaged in sort of diversifying their general businesses and why it's been allowed, even somewhat before Glass-Steagall. But, you know, sort of the marketplace has just changed. And everything is connected with the Eurobanks. You know, there aren't firewalls in Europe either. And so I think the banks would argue that for them it makes them more diverse and able to and agile when markets do change. But on the flip side of that, it does introduce risk to banks that maybe didn't exist before. And but they are, you know, they are currently having to deal with like very low interest 30-year mortgages, and trying to finance those over the lifetime of a loan is very difficult. Which is a whole other issue being debated in Washington, by the way, through housing reform and that sort of a thing. So it's just, it all gets very complex. And I think the senators and representatives are really struggling with this, and they want to address the too big to fail issue. They want to focus on sort of the capital charges and the broad amount of money that they have to hold, that banks have to hold as a backstop, as a prevention and a safety net technique. And the big issue comes is it going to be higher than Basel? Is it going to be something that is risk-based or not risk-based? Do we make it more simple so it's not, you know, buckets of risk that we have to calculate? And perhaps make it higher overall. So, you know, there's just all sorts of things that are being discussed right now. And actually next week, the Fed just announced that they're going to be taking up the concept of finalizing the Basel III regulations.
So, well, that'd be good. I mean, what's really amazing is, first of all, it's costing a lot of the firms a lot of money to do the whole Basel rules, of course, and there's been a series of them. And there's an international standard, I guess we can call it, right? And what's interesting is that on several times they've, you know, created these rules, and whoever created the rules, by the way, took them some time to put this together. It's not, you know, between the Dodd-Frank and the Basel, this wasn't slapped together overnight and said, hey, here's two pages and we want you to totally reform. I mean, there was this specific step, I don't want to say step by step, but the specific rules outlining what you have to do, right? And all these different things that were voted in and this. And meanwhile, the Basel rules kept getting pushed back because the banks couldn't meet the standards.
Right.
Now, it seems to me that, just to give you another kind of metaphor, that's like if you're drinking out of a water fountain and the allowed amount of particles for a contaminant are, you know, let's say 10 parts per million. And then all of a sudden the water starts getting, you know, you got 100 parts per million. They just raise up the allowable amount, you know, and the banks are being allowed to basically take the regulators by the nose and do what they want to do because they're not able to, for whatever reason, comply with all this. I mean, we've seen this where there's you know, stress test issues, or whether there's, just look at Greece, for example. They couldn't meet their situation for how long, and they just kept on saying, your government said, okay, you know what, we'll give you another 6 months. I mean, like I said, this is the only industry that I've ever seen. They get so much preferential treatment and the potential for bailouts. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because many of the U.S. banks, especially the largest U.S. banks, are meeting the current standards for Basel III implementation years before they're actually being implemented. The difference is that Basel III is being applied across the board to all banks and actually to all insurance companies that might own a banking thrift organization, for instance. And so what we've seen with the delay in Basel is it's really actually a lot of the community banks and some of the insurance companies who stepped up and tried to lobby to make some changes on that, to get some exemptions, to maybe get some extensions of their implementation timeline, because they're finding it difficult to come into compliance because they've never had to come at sort of a risk-weighted asset methodology before. And they're not used to this, and they're really coming up to speed. But when it comes to the largest U.S. banks, and we've done some analysis here at Bloomberg Government on this, is that, you know, when it comes to Basel III finally being implemented, they're largely in compliance, particularly with the capital charges.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a question of whether or not there'll be additional surcharges for those SIFI banks,
mm-hmm.
and how high they'll be. And if, A, it will prevent a future crisis or provide enough of a buffer,
mm-hmm.
B, might make it so that they have to decrease their total assets or find a way to kind of divest some of their business lines so that they can come into compliance with this, essentially breaking them up in some respect.
Mm-hmm.
Or C, you know, no change at all. Maybe those additional capital charges, they'll be able to comply with them. So those are things that are kind of up in the air, and we may get some of those questions answered next week when the Fed acts on this, is how they're treating the insurance companies, how they're treating the community banks, and what potentially there might be as far as a surcharge.
Now, in your best estimate, in terms of, let's get back to the Dodd-Frank for a second, in your best estimate, assuming that things go along with whatever speed that you're looking at, I mean, when is the best guess that this is going to be, like, quote-unquote, totally implemented?
Well, it's difficult to say. It's going to be years, honestly. I think this is going to be something that I'll be analyzing for years to come, based on, you know, changes that will happen in response to a lot of market forces and things like that. But let's look at something specific like the Volcker Rule. We've been waiting on a final Volcker Rule. You know, regulators are saying we're going to do it by the end of this year.
It's a simple thing, by the way, right? It's very simple.
It seems simple, right? It seems very simple. Just cut out your proprietary trading.
Right, that's it.
The issue is really in how you define the exemptions to this. So what constitutes a hedge, a legitimate hedge, and what constitutes market making versus building up inventory so that you are actually prop trading. And from a regulatory perspective, how to enforce that is a very, very big question mark. The interesting thing, though, about the Volcker Rules, the Fed can come in and actually extend the deadline up to 2017 for implementation of the Volcker Rule. So they can do that on a year-by-year basis, and I suspect that because that exists as an option, there's not as much pressure on the BART of regulators to go ahead and finish this right on time. So it's difficult to come to agreement in the first place, but they have kind of this built-in little safety valve that they can pull and say, nope, just wait a few more years, banks. We're going to keep working on this and find something that works for us and for you so that we can implement it.
It's such a nice story. They're going to be happy together and do things together, and hopefully, you know, they get it done in time for you to analyze before you and I are talking.
Before the next crisis.
Right. And that's even more important, before the next crisis. I mean, there is something that is brewing in China, which, you know, maybe people say, hey, that's way over there and all that. But remember something. I mean, when our financial institutions, you know, got hit, it took down the rest of the world. I'm not suggesting that that may happen. But already when we're starting to hear, when I hear the word injection into a bank, you know, the word that they're injecting money into liquidity into the banking system because it's liquidity, I get panicked. You know, I'm thinking, what is going on? The word that's just a really bad thing that has to happen. Why is there a lack of liquidity? Why is the whole system frozen up? You know, what's going on? And that's what we're seeing now. The panic for the investment crowd lasted a day and a half because they realized, I guess, at least from a perspective of, hey, we've seen this happen before in Europe and the United States. You know, the government will just come behind it and back it. You know, one day, as I always say, listen, the governments have come behind and backed the banks, right? We know that. And if they get in trouble, there's plenty of money. Now, the problem is that, you know, banks got into this debt issue. The banks got into all these problems and they had nowhere to go. So they had to go to the last lender of resort. Well, the problem is that a lot of the governments have now done a similar situation where they've done a tremendous amount of debt lending around, you know, they've issued debt and all that, and now they're creditors. And now the question is going to be is if one of these fails, who's going to save them? Who's left to be the lender of last resort? It's the man upstairs.
Certainly.
Man upstairs. He's the only one. Or she's the only one.
And when you consider these globally active banks across sovereign lines, how do you pay creditors? How do you determine who gets paid first? How is that process determined? And the global regulators are really grappling with that right now as well. And so that's another major issue.
But they do talk a good game, don't they?
They do. They talk a lot.
They could spin a web. They just come out and just say whatever needs to be said, regardless of its truth or accuracy, to make sure that markets are calm. I like it. I think it's a great game to play. Can you imagine if a company did that? Do you know how fast they would haul that guy off to jail?
Yeah, I can imagine.
I don't want to get you in trouble, sorry. I do a lot of ranting on this show. I apologize. Anyway, we try to get the facts and really talk about it in a usable way that people can understand. And, you know, there's more to this whole thing than just, you know, kind of this thing going together. This, unfortunately, we are all affected by this dramatically. You and I, everybody.
Certainly. And I do find it interesting as sort of a scholar and someone who studies kind of public policy and how politics sort of injected into all of this as a layer over how decisions are made is really interesting, and how it differs amongst sovereign lines and how people can do work together or don't work together. Mm-hmm. It is very interesting because it does, you're right, it does affect all of us.
Yep. Well, Kitty North from Bloomberg, and you know what, I'm going to pick that you do that, you do this tracker of the regulation tracker, and you do one on Dodd-Frank. I like how it's laid out because it's really kind of cool where, hey, what's happened, what hasn't happened, and it's color-coded and where we're up to and what's going to be happening and the completion rates. So we'll put this on the show notes so everybody can take a look at this and see what's going on with Dodd-Frank. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Andrew.
Okay, bye-bye. I think I may have freaked her out a little bit there on some of the things I was saying. What a nice person. She's great. Love talking with her. Love reading her writings. I don't know, actually, if we're going to be able to post the tracker that she put up there. But you could go to just look up Bloomberg Markets Government, do a search on that. And we'll try to put some things in the show notes as well for you on that. Now, I just want to mention that also we talked about the gold miners. We talked about the markets and what's kind of shaping up. Well, we have earnings season that's going to be starting very shortly. Of course, it kicks itself off with Alcoa, which has a tendency to rise into earnings. Everybody gets excited that maybe this quarter is the quarter that they can actually do well. And then the quarter comes out and the stock kind of moves higher as it goes down after that. I don't know if there'll be a change this time going into it, but there's been a lot of disappointment, and there's a lot of disappointment built into that right now. We've heard from last quarter that many companies are guiding lower and many investors are ignoring that. So, okay, we'll see. Does that mean that analysts also brought down their earnings numbers? Well, we are seeing that with revenues showing up one of the first times at a negative rate on a period over period for next quarter of the S&P 500, and the expectations to earnings to be pretty high, how's that going to play out? It's going to be kind of interesting because I'm not quite sure if the investors and the analysts are in sync right now with what the companies are saying. I'm not quite sure. Yes, markets are right for the time they are, as I mentioned at the top of the show, but at the same time, who knows where this is all playing out over the next few quarters. You know, BlackBerry is one of them that everybody thought that, hey, man, they got something now. They got this new touch screen and they're competing, you know, better late than never, I guess, with them. And they have maybe going to be able to win back their customers. Now, one of the things I always was wondering is if their customers were all about the BlackBerry device, the BlackBerry ecosystem, culture, and everything that was about the BlackBerry and why they liked the messaging and all that. And then the big issue was that they wouldn't switch to an iPhone or other kind of device because they really were used to their keyboard. But it took so much time for BlackBerry to come out with something. And when they did, they pretty much put the big F you up to their people. And they said, you know what? Here's our new device. It's a touchscreen. Now, why would anybody go with a BlackBerry with a touchscreen if the whole thing was all about, yeah, the ecosystem and all that, but the keyboard was so important? How stupid. The stock dropped the most in 13 years on Friday after revealing their latest update and earnings. And wouldn't you know it, there's been a lack of pickup on their latest device. I happened to be walking through an airport, and there was a couple of gents there, and they were standing with phones just facing out. And I'm like, what are they doing? Well, it happened to be a little live, I guess, lecture and seminar and show and tell about the new BlackBerry. So I went over there, and I looked at it, and I said, so this is it, the new BlackBerry. It looks just like an iPhone or an Android device. And I'm like, I looked at them. I said, why isn't anybody going to buy this? What's so special about it? What is going to be such the driver that's going to bring this company back to life when they lost the respect of most of their customers? They had nothing to say. Now, would I go and short BlackBerry into this? Probably not. That thing has a tendency to move all around, and you never know what's going to happen. And there's such a short interest on this already that who needs to be in front of a big short squeeze in front of earnings? What's going to happen with this company? We'll see. But I'm thinking Groupon. You know, I'm thinking potentially some other things. It's not really looking very healthy for them. And if this is something that you're buying, you know, think about the coal makers, those stocks, you know, that may be even better, even though those are on the verge of disaster themselves. And especially with President Obama coming out with a clean energy bill and essentially, you know, saying to the coal companies that, you know, we're going to shut you down. Natural gas is a better play, electric, et cetera. So that's not a great place to be if you're investing in those areas. Not a great feeling to have the government pretty much breathing down your neck and trying to shut you down. So that is going to be interesting. Now, next week, it's going to also be something to watch when you want to look at the ISM numbers that are going to be coming out. We also have the NFP numbers, of course, with the unemployment rate that will be out next Friday. But we also have the ISM manufacturing and the ISM services or non-manufacturing numbering come out. Now, I've been talking about how I've thought that there's going to be weakness, and there was, in fact, we're in contraction when it comes to the manufacturing. Now, I talked about this a month ago, and I said, you know, if you look at all the regionals and you look at what's going on, I'd be pretty surprised to see if manufacturing is going to hold up here. And it didn't. Now, analysts are saying that, hey, we're going to come out of the contraction. We're going to be over the 50 level on the next report. Very mixed bag this last couple of months in terms of where things are. We've seen the Philadelphia really go down, move a little bit better. We've seen the Empire State kind of be just sagging around. Chicago came out, and that was a little bit weak. So, you know, where is this manufacturing gain going to come from? It's going to be obviously domestically driven if it is going to happen. And, you know, that's about it. We're not exporting a lot these days. Durable goods were pretty ugly, even though everybody cheered a 3% move, but it's not so great. If you really think about the GDP that came in last week at 1.8%, that was nothing to really be excited about either. Markets felt it was because, hey, you know, lousy GDP means more stimulus. Woohoo! The stimulus party is here, the punch bowl is here, and they're spiking it, so says Lacker. We'll see what happens with that as well. Now, I got a couple of questions that came in I wanted to answer. Of course, you could write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I encourage you, I strongly encourage you, to go check out the 12 or 13-minute video and the virtual tour that we have about the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, where we buy stocks, we'll short stocks, use options, ETFs, like I talk about here on each and every episode, and I give you some of the insight into what we're doing. And if you haven't checked that out, you know what? And if you're kind of tired of just investing in the same old boring kind of way, well, go check it out because it's an actively traded strategy. And you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you could simply go there, click on the little blue box on the front page that says take a look at the virtual tour, and just watch the video and the virtual tour right there. It shows you a lot of what's going on. Now, there's some messages, emails that came in to me, and there's one from a gentleman named Hans, and he says that he goes towards a question of How exactly does it work when a new ETF or other new investment is issued? Whose money gets to be in on the inside before the release? And is the money of the company issued like the fund, which is usually an ETF? Do they gather together early adopters, collect their money, bring the instrument to market, higher price and all that? And how is it that is that significantly different from the illegal pump and dump schemes? Well, IPOs, Hans, are they come in different shapes and sizes. And realize that an ETF usually doesn't need an insider, doesn't usually have a pop because it's just a conglomeration of other investments, whether it's a sector play, whether it's a major market play, a commodity play, whatever it is. So an ETF, I don't really look at that as a, you know, exciting IPO. Now, when a company comes to an IPO, they may have started out way back when in a venture capital situation where they have the early adopters, the first guys, and they get a piece of the company. Then they bring in other guys and they have to refund a second round funding and they have those guys and they get a smaller cut and on and on and on until they, you know, move up. You have even way back when you have the mezzanine financing and, you know, things like that that can come into play, but all the way up till where the company is doing well and now you have an IPO. Now, IPO, you have all these people that are involved. You have the investment bankers and the sellers are obviously all the people that had provided the money previously and they're selling a portion of their position in the company. And you get the benefit if you have an account at some of these major players and you can get an IPO. Not all of them work out well, but you hear about the ones that work out well and they seem pretty exciting. I've seen pretty rotten ones in my day. And what happens is that you invest in these IPOs and you get at the pre-price of, let's say, $18 where it goes public. Hopefully it goes to $30 and you're in great shape. So again, it works a little bit differently for each one, but essentially it starts with a group of people that have an idea, they get investors, the investors then open it up to further investment and on until they come up to the IPO and they're going to do a public offering. Many companies decide to stay private, a lot less hassle. Now, another listener wrote in and he asked me about, hey, do I know any books that are investment books, but not specifically technically related to fundamentally and all that? So I thought I'd give you a few that I like. I mean, I think that it's necessary. How to Make Money in Stocks by William O'Neill is a great piece to read. It just gives you a really good perspective on history of stocks, patterns, and a lot of things that go into deciding what stocks to use and maybe, you know, in your portfolio and whatnot. So that's great. How to Make Money in Stocks. Reminiscence of a Stock Operator is just a fabulous book written in, I think, the 20s. I think it was the 20s. But this is a great book just to look at the history of, as they call a stock operator or a person who was at that time a speculator. Reminiscence of a Stock Operator. Now, although I may not like certain things, I think it's really good reading, small, very thin book. Jim Cramer, yes, the Jim Cramer, wrote a book called Confessions of a Street Addict. Now, I think the whole point of this is to read it to understand just how sleazy the street really is, to understand what hedge funds do, how they operate, and some of the things, some of the lengths that they'll go to make money and what can happen and how they take on risk. And finally, the Zurich Axioms. You have to look that up, Zurich Axioms. Look that up and you'll find it. It's usually available in PDF. I think we have it on our site somewhere. You can grab a copy of it. That's a great, great book. The one thing that I remember out of that, very short, is if you're going to do something, do it big. Or don't bother playing. You know, if you're going to be committed to something, just be committed to it. Don't waffle. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up right there. Thank you for joining me. Make sure to check out the virtual tour over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, Trigger Point Research, which you have a 14-day free trial. And also, I mentioned that for all of you, you need to write me. If you have TradeStation and you're using TradeStation, you need to write me. I'm not kidding. Just say, hey, tell me about TradeStation. And I'll tell you some information about it because there's something coming out that you need to know about with TradeStation. And I can't spill the beans right now, but I'll keep you on that list and make sure to write me. And in fact, we'll try to put up maybe some kind of a quick form that you could fill out so we can keep you on the list. But if you're using TradeStation, write Ask Andrew at the Disciplined Investor and just write TradeStation and we'll put you in a list so that when the news breaks, you'll know about it. Okay. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company. a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.